have some Glenning for that one.
I've read all four in the past Glenning. And recently.
Ooh. Wow,
I have
you
some
win,
Glenning,
mom.
Too.
Oh, Glenning is excellent. All right. Well, this is
a second
be
degree Glenning. Only second degree.
All right. Here we go.
Recording.
Recording.
Oops, recording. Yeah, recording.
Is everybody recording?
I am now recording.
Yeah. Lisa. Yay! Blood saves a podcast.
Yes! So that's what the score is, what, 1 to 5,000?
Yeah, he's ruined far more, but at least he saved one.
Okay.
All right, where are we now?
My Glenning, when I lived near Princeton, I met John McPhee.
Oh.
Because he teaches at Princeton, or taught at Princeton. Mm-hmm. There you go. Glenning!
I don't know if it's Glenning if you just met somebody once.
That's right.
I think there has to be a convoluted backstory.
Well, that's right, true. That's right. I don't know any of his service people. I just know him.
Yeah, that's kind of weak.
Yeah, that's just name dropping. Yeah. That's not Glenning.
That's right. That's Glenning. Glenn's rise to the heights of...
I'm glad Glenn's not here. To hear
I probably us. Did meet the guy who served him coffee every day.
Mm.
So there's that.
Good stuff.
That's the secret ingredient, more coffee.
Yeah, House was the first thing of his I ever read, because at the time, you know, it was like a bestseller, so it was in all the bookstores and all the department stores and on the book sections. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. And I already liked John McPhee, who, if you want to look for the gold standard in nonfiction writing, John McPhee, I'll read anything he writes, doesn't matter what it's about. I'm not quite there with Kidder, but but I really liked that, and I really liked Soul of a New Machine, because it was, you know... At the time, I was fascinated by this. I knew I was never going to work at it or do anything with it, but it was just fascinating, you know, to me.
I want to interrupt quickly, but John McPhee, just by the way, I just read his book about nuclear – from the early 70s about nuclear weapons and his fear that plutonium – which almost became true if he hadn't written that book and some other people hadn't done things. But it's fascinating because it's the same kind of super geeky – community of people doing crazy stuff, like in the 40s and 50s and 60s, working these nutty shifts at Los Alamos and places to create a new technology. It just was highly analog, involved blowing things up and killing things. But it was, I would say McPhee's book is a good predecessor for this. And it's, I don't know how much Kidder was influenced by McPhee. I assume so, but I don't know
if
he's more contemporary.
Yeah, he's gone on the record saying that McPhee is like his idol and everything he does is basically him trying to be McPhee.
Oh my gosh! Well, you can, but McPhee has his own. I mean,
you can tell. Yeah.
Oh, the curve of binding energy is that book. I just read it, and it's a quick, crazy read. And you're like, thank God, it's 40 years later, and none of this stuff has happened. How is it possible? Anyway, thank you for letting me interrupt.
Selling a BASIC for the Altair, which turned into BASIC for a CPM machine, and then turned into BASIC for TRS-80s. And then was the BASIC that was included on PC-DOS.
Yes, and the Apple II was based on – they had to license from Microsoft for the Apple BASIC.
I owned a computer in 1979. I owned an Ohio Scientific Incorporated C1P, a 6502-based machine, just like the Apple II, and it had Microsoft BASIC on it. And it was spelled micro space soft. And I was like – I looked at it. I remember this as a kid looking at it going, who are those jerks?
Well, little Microsoft. Did you know, Glenn, you'd moved to Seattle and your little self.
And you met those jerks. You found out who those jerks were.
We had a computer called an Altos, which was really a business machine, had 8.5-inch floppies.
Yes.
And we had our choice of BASICs on this. There was MBASIC, that was Microsoft, and it was the best because it was an interpreter BASIC. I also remember eBASIC and CBASIC that both were compiled, and they were much less fun to screw around with.
We had an Apple IIc, and what I remember really vividly was the disk caddy that my mother bought and set up next to the computer so that we could preserve the disks with no dust on them whatsoever.
Oh,
nice.
Do that.
Yeah.
One of those, too.
I remember 8-inch disks. It was like working with pizzas. You were like sliding into the pizza oven.
Yeah, my kids talk about, oh, and there are disks that were big and all that. And it's like, you guys don't even know. I think they're thinking of the little ones. And it's like, there were ones that were bigger than that. And then there were the ones that were even bigger than that.
Yeah.
No, one of my favorite comics on the internet is the Natalie D one, where you see a stereotypical bespectacled nerd clutching his backpack and thinking longingly of a purple zip disk. And the caption just reads nerd memories. And I'm like, I stood in line for a zip drive. I stood in line and dropped $300 because I desperately needed portable storage for all of the files I was working on.
Well, yeah, these kids today, you know, I'm telling you, they don't
with
they
their
don't
clouds
understand.
And their
the zip disk was what? Was 1 gigabyte?
No, it was 100 megabytes.
I'm looking at one right now.
And a floppy was 1 megabyte.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so it was 100 times a floppy.
Yeah, because the first time I had to work on a Photoshop project for grad school, and it was like 3 megabytes. I'm like, I can't save this to disk. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's it. No, that's it. It was revolutionary in its way and also totally unreliable. And,
It spun. It's true. It spun.
But it was mm-hmm. It was just a little removable hard drive.
It's revolutionary. No, I've got a little zip drive there and a zip disk and a pocket zip. They're just gathering dust.
Where's your Bernoulli drive?
So I was just gonna say I had a good friend who had Bernoulli box. He was like, "Hey, look at my Bernoulli box!" And he had it for like 6 months and he got rid of it. And but he would rebuild his whole computer system every 6 months. It was freakish.
How do you do that?
I had one catch on fire in 2001. So they sure do. Yeah.
That
was
school.
14 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My laptop did have all four of its little rubber feet melt off this summer.
Oh.
I will say, I did have a Sony Vaio that, now it's coming up about 4 years ago, was sitting on my desk and just went, poof! And I just saw little tendrils of smoke coming out of it. And it was the power supply, and it was a very proprietary shaped one, so they don't make it anymore. There is no way to restore that computer, and that's why I have a Mac now.
Mm. Yay!
It just works.
May I indulge in some brief glenning?
Please do.
Please do.
One of the things that happens in this book is that all hackers become fascinated with something, like the game of life, which I've never cared about, but was very important to people at one point.
Yeah.
Or
Stephen Levy jumped off and wrote an entire book about those people.
Or Eliza.
Oh,
yes. Tell me, do you have any psychological problems?
I don't. Well, I possibly do. But in this case... In this case, I am pals with Natalie Weizenbaum, the granddaughter of Joseph Weizenbaum, the creator of Eliza.
Oh,
so what was it like talking to her grandfather? Did he just ask a lot of leading questions and let her prattle on? Or
No, she says that's just something he wrote a million years ago. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, thought it would be funny.
He shows up in this book. He also shows up in Cuckoo's Egg in some other context besides Eliza. Hmm.
He really wants to be known for his earlier, funnier works better.
Oh, Eliza. She was
People
great.
Do talk to online bots and AIs like crazy. In grad school, my friend Cliff and I built one where he did a lot of the work in the Perl, and then I taught it how to respond to thing using season one friend scripts, because it all comes back to Matthew Perry.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it does. Yeah?
But it all comes, and we named it Bob, and people would talk to Bob and ask questions, and Bob would reply with lines from friends that were contextually appropriate. And I used to take time to teach Bob how to respond to things, and we would have people who talked to it for hours.
And now that technology is being put to use, making nearly convincing comment thread posts that have been linked to Viagra sales.
Or perhaps they're all running Ashley Madison accounts. You never
still have bots.
The Bayesian Markov chain bots. Like, I have a friend who made one. You know, she's a Gamergate adjacent person, and people get into arguments all the time with her eBooks account that is a bot. And I see people, because they're mansplaining, so they keep talking at her, and it responds with these things that sound sometimes like she's agreeing with them. Sometimes she says, "No, bad bot, bad," because it says something antithetical to what she actually believes. It's rather wonderful. Wonderful. I got a sidebar, though, which is that this is my glenning for this, is that early in the book. So you remember early in the book that Stoll tracks down this high school kid. Remember that part? Sort of this innocuous guy, and they call the police on him, and he's like, you know, he's just this high school kid who's hacked into their systems, right? Remember that? No? Anybody? No.
Oh, is this the one at who was hacking into the Stanford?
It's earlier in the book, because he's not a master spy. He's some kid in high school. So I'm reading this book. It has his name in the book. His name is mentioned by name. And I forget if he was charged or what the deal was. I don't think he could use computers for a while after that. So I'm working at Amazon, and I read this book at some point like in 97 or so, I think, after I left Amazon, maybe for the second time at that point, because I know I'd read it earlier. And the second time reading, I'm like, wait a minute. I know that name. He was one of the early Amazon employees. And I sent him an email. Wait a minute. This is an unusual name. Is this – I don't want to mention his name because it'll – you know, eventually this podcast,
what's all
podcasts
will name? Be
text. Yeah, they'll all be text recognized. So in the future, all podcast audio. And he says, is this you? He's like, oh, my God, please don't bring that up. I have lurked so hard to get past that. I wasn't allowed to use computers for X years. Wow. I went off to college. I didn't touch them. And then I got back involved and now I'm here. And I'm like, oh, my God, I won't tell anybody. Someone else may read the book and discover it. The connection, but you know, the book at that point was years old, yet he was working for a company that was making it really easy to get books that weren't in print.
Yes. Yeah. Oh God, that was the thing that used to drive me bonkers about IDG, is they'd make you change your password like every 6 to 12 weeks, and it had to be.
Well, that's not IDG. That is a state of Massachusetts information technology requirement.
Oh my.
Okay, thank you for clarifying.
Too bad passwords, because then people can't remember them.
I have an Evernote still in my archives with a running list of all the passwords I used at IDG, and you can encrypt you can password protect all of your Evernote notes if you want. You can password protect them individually, but I thought, this is so dumb that I have to keep a running list of passwords because all somebody
has
to
do use them.
No, right? I know. And right. they had to have both capital and lowercase letters and numbers and special characters. And since they were being cycled through so frequently, I had to keep a list of, okay, here are all the school-related things I've drawn already. Here are all the sports-related things I've done already. Here are all the childhood literature things I've done already. And just, you know, cycle through that way. And I kept thinking, this is so dumb. This is so insecure. I guarantee you, there are people in my organization who are using Post-its to keep track of their passwords.
Well, you know, I'm not sure Post-its are insecure. They're not on the internet.
Mm. No, I have a column I need to write about the fact that writing your password down is possibly one of the most secure things you can do, as long, because people don't typically break into your house by the millions to try to steal that Post-it note.
Mm-hmm.
You only have to worry about the people around you. Don't trust anyone around you. But
when I was working at Wired, there was a former employee who used to wait around till everybody left, and then he would systematically rifle through the trash to see what people were throwing away, like if there were interesting memos or something. And then he'd very casually hit the keys on computers to see if the computers were asleep. And if they woke up when he hit the key, he'd go through their email and check their.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so, like, that was, because I caught him doing it one night, and that was like vivid lesson number one, that the most secure thing you can possibly do is like shut down your computer, throw everything out every night, take the computer with you when possible.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one person who's just kind of wandering around, he knew everything about every legal deal that the company was doing, everything else, because he would go through and read like email drafts. He'd go through and read the thrown out email. He would reconstruct things and then just, you know, act on it from there.
You can never defend against the sociopath you work with.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you can, but it, you know, you can't assume that everybody who's on the inside is you know, it's safe if it's safe,
you
if
can't
it's in the office, right?
Yeah.
I think both Monty and I have a sidebar, another sidebar about Cliff. Cliff Stoll, but Monty, you want to go first? I have something that's based off that, though.
After this book, Cliff Stoll became kind of famous as like the famous computer security guy, which was never a role he was super happy with.
No.
He ended up being a columnist on internet things for various subjects.
Oh, yeah.
One thing he wrote was a legendarily wrong column for Newsweek in February of 1995.
I remember that well.
Me too. I remember being shocked by it. Clifford Stoll, how could you?
Two of the things he said in it are, the truth is, no online database will replace your daily newspaper. No CD-ROM can take the place of a competent teacher. And no computer network will change the way government works.
Mm-hmm. Also, e-commerce will never work.
Yeah. And he also said that URLs would never fly, that people would never bother to write down or remember URLs. He's like, that's too cumbersome. No one will ever bother.
Yeah. And his cyber business paragraph is much in the same vein, but longer. The key part there is, even if there was a trustworthy way to send money over the internet, which there isn't, the network is missing a most essential ingredient of capitalism, salespeople. And it was around 1995 where the hippie in him started coming out, and he no longer liked what the internet had become and what it was doing to people.
There
was a book that came out of it called
Silicon Snake Oil.
Yeah, which I read. I think I read it a few years. The thing is, I picked it up, I want to say, it came out in 96. Well, I think it technically published in 95, but I'm finding a 96 date on it too. So I think he had written that column, and then on the strength of that, which is what you do. You write a crazy column, and I have a friend whose book career is partly because she wrote something, a New York Times Modern Love column, and it turned mm-hmm. into like a best-selling book. It was awesome because people were so mad at her. So people were mad at him, and they're like, book contract. And mm-hmm. he wrote this book, and I don't think it did well at all, but it's been people cite it all the time.
Yeah.
And I read it, and it was full of like ridiculous stuff. He's like, when I press a key of a telnet session, it takes now 12 seconds for the key to go there and back. And I'm like, it's only getting worse. I mean, it was full of even more stuff. But then there's this whole section in it about education and about computers and education and how badly they're being deployed. Now, the thing is, the book is full of wrongness and bad predictions. Everything he said about education, it has been my Bible. I can go back to it and find these things where it's like the teachers aren't trained, the software is make ready, it's rote, there's no measurement of results. They're buying computers, they put and like all this stuff. And remember when the state of Maine several years ago said, hey, we're going to buy MacBooks for all. Was it all the seventh graders, I
yeah.
think?
Yeah, it was one of them.
And they said, and we're going to study. Part of the money is we're going to study the outcome and see what happens. I'm like, this is great. And a year or two later, I'm reading this report. This is we're measuring some of the outcomes. And they had sent surveys to all the principals, and only like 20% had responded. And their measurements were like, do you think things are better? Like, they didn't measure. There was no like quantitative anything. I write something about this on my blog. Mm-hmm. One of the study authors comes, engages me. What are you talking about? There's all in like, well, how many people? What was the absentee rate? Did you have, were there better scores? He's like, well, blah, blah, sure, whatever, you know? And you're like, wait a minute. This is the same thing happening. And Cyrus Farivar, a former Macworld intern and writer, and mm-hmm. Now at Ars Technica, has been kind of picked up that mantle a few years ago of writing about every time something like one laptop per child. Same thing. Well, give kids computers. You just give them a computer.
Computers of the future.
They'll learn a programming language, and then they will suddenly that Africa will be the first nation instead of the third. But like all the naivete that's discovered again and again, and Seymour Papert, and all like throughout history, there's a book I read a few years ago. I'm blanking out of the name that I think Cyrus told me to read. In fact, that was like almost it wasn't a follow up of Silicon Snake Oil, but it looked comprehensively at mm-hmm. computer education from the 1950s and Papert and some of the, in Smalltalk all the way to the present. And what was consistently the case is computers are really good at teaching people to read better if they're not very literate, mm-hmm. and they're really good at drilling people on math. And the jury is out on every single other use of pedagogy because most of it is so non-rigorous you can't get outcomes.
There's a rising body of academic research that shows in terms of information retention that if you are taking notes on a laptop first and foremost, you retain significantly less of the information than if you're actually writing it down and then retyping your notes on a laptop. And they're trying to figure out why it is that laptops don't let you absorb as easily. Ooh. But there's definitely like some sort of weird like kinesthetic element to learning that we're only now unlocking, and mm-hmm. and they're quantifying that now because they're using college classrooms where you have a majority of kids who are bringing in their own laptops or tablets to take notes, and then when you test them on retention against people who have been handwriting, and you do the control and you control for everything, all of things being equal, the kids who handwrite things actually learn better and more effectively the first time around.
I believe there's a very wonderful discussion about that by one Mr. Jason Snell on another mm-hmm. podcast.
Yes, you can check it. I want to say episode 51 of Upgrade.
Probably.
Mm-hmm. It might have been 50, but you can check it out.
I would love to, yeah.
Just we talked about that study a little bit. And you know what's interesting about that study, and we are completely off the rails now, but what's interesting about
Excellent.
That study is that it's a they tried to tell the people who were using the computers to take notes to summarize and not do verbatim, and it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. Even if they did that, they still didn't recall at the same level as somebody who was doing it by hand. So
yeah.
There's more to it than that. But I think to back this,
a friend of mine got into like a slap party in her because she's a college teacher and she bans laptops in her classroom, and sounds like blah blah blah. And she's like, no, I actually work with somebody who's studying this and how information is absorbed, and she's promising to send me the white papers from her colleague. So. Dude, I'll pass them on to you too.
Because I thought she said she got involved in a slap party, and I was like, "What?
Yeah. Oh yeah, no. That's what they get to in college now."
Yes, the kids today with their laptop computers and their slap parties.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So to pull it back out, what we're really uh-huh. saying is like Cliff Stoll, even among his hippiness exerting itself and writing Silicon Snake Oil, you know, some of his skepticism has been proven to be right, which is about the skepticism about using technology in education. Other parts of his skepticism completely wrong. If you want to know what Cliff Stoll is doing now, he taught elementary school for a while or middle school, and he does a lot of glass blowing. Not a euphemism.
makes Klein bottles.
He does.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's what he does.
Look those up. They're very cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
he's apparently a very nice man, by the way. He sounds like
it's
a crank,
hard not but I think, to think he, that having yeah, read the Cuckoo.
That's what I've heard. I know people have met him and they say he's a really gentle, wonderful guy. I mean, mm-hmm. astronomy was his passion and he got directed in this other field and he's found something quite interesting, a number of interesting things to do with himself. But I don't think he turned into one of those like angry old cranks. I mean, old. He's probably 50 now or something, right?
So, no, he's 65 now.
Yeah. Oh, no. Tell me that's not true. Yeah, holy cow, the math. You're right.
Yeah, but he's one of those 65-year-old hippies, so he probably looks great.
Yeah, I'm sure he does, but I'm like, oh, I still picture him as like a 27-year-old guy.
What I really like about him is he actually owns how bad Silicon Snake Oil was. Yeah. Like he's on the record in several places saying, yeah, it's a huge howler. I was trying really hard. I totally misspoke. Gets out in the public record. Like, he's a really graceful loser. It's a great model for like basically everybody else on the internet.
He was trying to be controversial, and he was. He said a lot of stuff that I think because he was unhappy with people being swept up in the tide. And I think he said, you know, there are valid arguments to make against this, and he made all the arguments he made were not totally unreasonable at the time, but very quickly totally unreasonable. Yeah. Some of them were totally unreasonable.
I think he was trying to make two arguments, one which was correct, which is if the internet becomes. He was saying, I don't think the internet's going to become as ubiquitous as you people all think it is. He was wrong about that.
Yeah.
But he was also saying, and if it does, that's not 100% a good thing.
Yes.
And he ain't wrong about that. And I can do some glenning on that because I was on CompuServe at the time in the RP Games Forum. And I had actually playtested that version of GURPS Cyberpunk. That the Secret Service came and took away, the one Lloyd Blankenship wrote.
Wow.
Sorry, sir. This game is dangerous to national security.
Oh, my God. They were just a role-playing and card game company that happened to employ a guy who happened to run a BBS for, I forget which group, the Lords of Chaos, maybe?
What
was it? Legion of Doom?
Legion of Doom, that's who it was.
I really dislike all of these names. I feel like you're just trolling when you name things like that. Your group should have like as boring and incomprehensible a name as possible. Like
that doesn't make
international
you feel,
export.
Yeah,
that doesn't
no,
make you feel awesome though. You
like unified
people.
Consolidate, like you know Viridian Dynamics maybe. But
I and my colleagues from the league known as International Export. No, it just doesn't do it. I've been to Glenn's house. Does that count as glenning? No.
But you met his mailman.
You know, I am on a podcast with Monty, and Monty was at Glenn's house recently, where I was.
I have a very similar story, but with Jason instead of Monty.
You know, I was recently in a hotel room with several people who know Glenn, but I still haven't met Glenn.
No.
It's true. It's
in the same state as Glenn.
Ever closer.
It was a different pace, I think. You know? What is interesting about the scope of computing in those early books is this is treated very much like a subculture because it legitimately was. This was a very small group of people within larger society. Hyperconnectivity was not the norm. Having vast amounts of computing power and a 24/7 e-commerce infrastructure and thousands upon thousands of data gathering things weren't the norm. It really was a different pace in computing and in networking and in interfacing with other people, both online and offline. I think your observation is completely valid. And the book I would like to see written actually is the one that might examine how the rate of acceleration of technological innovation may have contributed to a rate of acceleration in both in either narrative form or in like culture at large. Because we do live in a time now where people are like outraged if they can't get all 13 episodes of a TV season on their computer at once.
Oh, Amazon just launched Amazon Super Duper Prime, Prime Now. And I can get anything in an hour in Seattle from, you know, this list of a few thousand items. Like, no, I want it slower. I liked Cosmos, but I want it slower.
Yeah.
I where I live, I get Mayberry Prime. It comes in about 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Whistling.
But with a pie.
It's like the 90s where you are.
Well, that's true.
But yeah, I do wonder if there's like a feedback loop effect between the accelerated rate of networking and technology and communications and like commercial gratification with, oh, again, I can see all 13 episodes of a TV season if I want in one night, you know, as opposed to having to wait 3 months to see them week by week by week. And the sense of acceleration in terms of the pace of business or the pace of life or what have you, it's, you know, we've taken the slow out of it somehow.
Mm-hmm. I owned out.com in 1995, nice. Which mm-hmm. I registered for a friend, and it was one of the first domain names sold, in fact. I think we sold it for $1,000.
My friends Linda and Dean sat down one night with a dictionary program and a script he had written. This is back when they were both working at Wired, and they had an Apache server Dean whipped up, and they basically auto-registered something like 1,000 different domains for speculation and would sell them whenever they felt like it. And Linda managed to finance like a trip around the world on it. So.
I was able to make the down payment on my house with one domain name I happened to register that sold a few years after that.
Wow. Oh, which one?
I think it was share.com. See, I had like I was registering domain names in 94 and 95 for real things. So out and share and faucet and build and like all these words. Mm-hmm. And I was like, everyone's going to want company names. Who wants these generic words? These are terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at Wizard of the Coast, we had games.com and we could never figure out what to do with it. And I think we ended up selling it to some other company.
We registered film.com, which was its own thing. And then it got bought by Real Networks and that eventually helped pay for my roof.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'll be happy to know that OOP.com just throws PHP errors.
Yeah,
I just, of course, we all looked it up, didn't we?
Yep. And at the moment when the narrator changes his email address, the line in the book is, I am now Daniel at OOP.com. At could become the Mook or Mac of the next millennium. And that's a pretty good prediction because everybody's got an at now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A slightly different medium than email, but still.
Yeah. But everyone.
I mean, it is an email.
Yeah. Microservices is the rare book where I do wonder what happens to the characters. Like, I wonder what happens to them where they are now.
Yeah.
For example.
Oh,
And I kind of don't want to know because I have more fun making up the stories in my head. But I think it's one of those books where it comes along at the right time, and people are like, "I want to." I can't tell you how many web pages I ran across where someone's like, "I want to live in a geek house like in Microsurfs," and that like sounds great when you're 22 and you're already used to dorm life and you have roommates and things like that. And now I think back, if I had to live with like five of my coworkers on a regular basis,
yeah,
I still think it would make a good show.
Sure.
It's a young person show.
Sure. Well, you know, Silicon Valley owes a lot to this line of inquiry. Anyway,
so does The Real World on MTV.
Fair point. All right, I'm going to call it. Thank you, everybody. Send me your files. Time of death. 9:42.
Good night, everybody.
All right, thank you. Good night.